words used to describe the suffering of Israelis killed by Hamas on October 7th, 2023, have been very empathetic and very emotional. So let's take the word slaughter. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times used the word slaughter 60 different times to describe what Hamas had done to Israelis on October 7th. But those same media outlets used the word slaughter only once to describe what had been done in the first 6 weeks of the war on Gaza to the Palestinians. And that's just in the first month and a half of the war. This kind of imbalance really conveys to the public in the United States that some lives really matter and some lives really don't.
Norman, related to what you just discussed, you also make the claim that mainstream discourse has avoided reporting on those who have condemned the U.S. government for its role in the slaughter of civilians. Do you mean by that that voices from the movement against what Israel and the U.S. is doing in Gaza? Or do you mean that it's not reporting on voices from the U.S. government speaking out against the war? Please explain.
We've had very little coverage about the content of the movement against the U.S.-backed Israeli war on Gaza. A lot of discussion, especially in the spring, of the campus movements, the demonstrations, the encampments, where thousands and thousands of students were active to demand an end to the U.S. government's support of the slaughter in Gaza. And so the quantity of coverage of protests was certainly very big. The quality of it was a whole other matter. Very rarely did we actually hear from the protesters directly. They were talked about, they weren't heard from. And a lot of the coverage that did exist of their activities, and more broadly, protests around the country about the war on Gaza, the media coverage was often defamatory. It was negative. It said that these people were maybe misguided, uninformed, and or anti-Semitic, which was a real slander. Ironic, because a lot of those protests were led by Jewish people here in the United States.
And Norman, what about people in the U.S. government speaking out against the war? Was there any coverage of that?
There have been a number of people in the U.S. State Department and elsewhere in various agencies who have resigned explicitly in protest, often with very moving letters to the president or the secretary of state saying, "I cannot abide remaining in this government while it supports genocide against people in Gaza," when most of the victims, acknowledged to be now over 40,000, and that's an underestimate, being children and women. "I cannot stay in this government. I am resigning in protest." And when that has happened, there has been some fleeting coverage. You would have an article in a daily newspaper, such as the New York Times and Washington Post. There might be an interview on CNN or another network, but very briefly. And the essence of a propaganda system is not the brief, occasional, the exception. It's the routine. That's the essence of propaganda, and the framework and the assumptions and the overwhelming quantity and type of sources that are being quoted and cited. So unfortunately, even though these have often been very profound moral statements and people sacrificing their own careers in government to protest against this genocide, generally the U.S. news media have given those protests and those acts of conscience very short shrift.
And Norman Solomon, you also claim that the media generally portrays, reports, if you will, the deaths of in Gaza of the Palestinians as quote unquote unintended, that claims by Israel that they were making good faith efforts to minimize civilian deaths, well, they go unchallenged. Talk to us about that.
That's a paradigm that has been just so consistent throughout the so-called U.S. war on terror in the last 23 years. And it has been accentuated, I think, even more egregiously in terms of the line that has come out from Washington and the Israeli government vis-a-vis the war in Gaza. It's really a cop-out, it's an excuse, and it's a standard way of trying to use words to blow away the realities of what these wars have been doing. The fact is, these deaths of civilians are entirely predictable, they are entirely foreseeable, and anybody who is at all conscious in a military hierarchy will know that when you drop these bombs on people in civilian areas, you're going to be killing a lot of children and women and other civilians. And yet the pretense is there. It's unintended. Therefore, it isn't something that we're culpable for, we're responsible for. And I give an analogy in the book of, let's say that some criminals are being chased in a downtown shopping area near where you live, and the police are spraying the front of the stores with machine gun fire and going up and down the street during the middle of the day, just firing willy-nilly at people because they say there are some criminals maybe in some of the stores. Well, the police could always say, oh, look, all these deaths, there are these dead bodies all over town. They're civilians, women and children, but we didn't intend it, so we're off the hook. That is preposterous. And then you add to that the very clear evidence the Israeli government is intentionally killing civilians. There is no doubt about it that this is a concerted effort, including even the use of 2,000-pound bombs in very heavily populated urban areas. This is a goal of the Israeli government. And if any listener is going to say, oh, that sounds anti-Semitic, by the way, I'm Jewish. And I understand what the ideology is operating now in terms of the policies in Israel. Add to that the fact that starvation is being used as a weapon of war by Israel. That has been true beginning in October of 2023. It has been verified by the United Nations, and it's a war crime. And the fact is that the United States has been supporting the Israeli government as it engages in methodical war criminality, including using the denial of food as a weapon of war.
Overall, in sum, perhaps in a sense, you claim that the news media, as well as the U.S. government officials, in broad strokes, have both displayed really a mindset that in some shows that they believe Israeli lives, well, they matter a great deal more than do Palestinian lives. That's what this seems to be all about, doesn't it, Norman?
Well, very much. It's reflected in the way that the news media and those in political power in Washington use language and promote their policies. When the United States, and just in the last couple of months, has green-lighted about $25 billion with a B dollars, more weapons to the Israeli government while it engages in continued mass murder, mostly of civilians, in Gaza, what conclusions are we to draw? We could use an analogy. People may remember the terrible tragedy in Uvalde, Texas, where guns were sold to an unhinged young man who went out and slaughtered people at a school. And there were questions raised afterward. Well, the weapons were bought at a gun shop. How could the gun shop owner sell the weapons to this person? And the response was, well, the gun shop owner didn't know how the weapons were going to be used. In contrast, the president of the United States knew and has known how the weapons were being used and yet continued to send them. And that's where the clarity of the actual motivations and activities of the Israeli government should come into clear focus. This is something that has been dodged by the U.S. media. And I give an example in the book where in February of this year, after coming back from the border of Gaza and Egypt, the border of Gaza and Israel, Senator Van Hollen from Maryland gave a very moving speech on the Senate floor. And he said, the denial of food to starving people is a war crime, and the leaders of the Israeli government are war criminals. He said that point blank. And a few hours later, the same Senator Van Hollen voted to send $14 billion worth more of weapons to leaders he had just called war criminals. And this is the kind of doublethink involved that is so pernicious and makes the U.S. government an accomplice to mass murder and genocide.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host Jim Lafferty. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. We're interviewing Norman Solomon about his new book. Norman, I wonder, do you perhaps also feel that the news media has gone out of its way to portray the slogans and demands of the pro-Palestinian movement on campuses and elsewhere as being largely and unquestionably anti-Semitic, and that they fail to cover the arguments as to why those slogans and demands are not anti-Semitic?
With very rare exceptions, that is the case. It is a reflex. It has been in place for decades when criticisms have been made of the Israeli government, and it has been greatly accentuated in the last 12 months. And it's really been a scam on a propaganda basis operated by the Israeli government and its supporters in the United States. This is the gist. For decades, Israel has been engaged in ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. It has been periodically killing thousands of civilians in Gaza. It has evicted so many Palestinians from their homes. And yet, whenever the apartheid system, and it is an apartheid system in Israel, gets publicly criticized, it is so often that the criticism is denounced as anti-Semitism. And the technique is, even though Israel is committing all of these crimes on a daily basis, these horrific policies against our fellow human beings, the Palestinians, when those policies are criticized, the Israeli government and its supporters wrap those crimes in the Jewish religion. And it's a basic, very fundamental newspeak, doublethink maneuver that we need to challenge directly.
You know, Norman, I'm wondering, when you think about the bias that you've just demonstrated and pointed out to us, a media monopoly pretty much in this country today, isn't it? Five major corporations owning the main sources of media that people are exposed to and have. It's a capitalist society. So long as that's the case, how realistic is it to think that one can effectively challenge this media bias around Israel and the war in Gaza or around anything else, frankly?
It's a pretty powerful corporate media wall, and yet the wall has cracks in it. And those cracks sometimes become very significant when we think about even the Iraq War, which was cheerled by U.S. corporate media. As protests grew and as people saw through the excuses for U.S. aggression on Iraq, public sentiment really changed. I think it's really dramatic and very telling that even though there has been an ongoing propaganda barrage in favor of Israel, and certainly intensified in the last year, the majority of people in the United States, according to polls, want an arms embargo against Israel. And I think that's quite remarkable. Despite the failure of people on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, whether in Congress or the White House, to actually speak clearly about these terrible atrocities being committed by the U.S.-backed Israeli military on a daily basis, most of the U.S. public, despite the media coverage, doesn't want the weapons to keep going to the Israeli military. And I think that goes to the fact that propaganda has its limits, and independent media outlets, including ones like we're speaking on today, when people take the initiative, they say, we're not going to be defeatist about this, we're realistic, but there are other messages, there are other voices that have to be heard, and that really can make a difference in the long run.
Norman Solomon, in the book, we've been talking about your latest and up-to-date afterword about the invisibility of and the bias of the media with respect to the war in the Middle East, the war in Israel and waging in Gaza and so forth. But the book itself, I think, it makes the point in an overarching way that I'd like you to share with our audience. I mean, talk to us about how the extent of militarism in the United States, the number of military bases we have, the number of conflicts on a daily basis the U.S. military is involved in, either directly or in some kind of advice capacity. Talk to us about any number of aspects of what you write about so brilliantly in the invisibility of war, if you will, and how that ties in what we've been talking about thus far on the show.
Overseas, very few people in this country are aware that there are 750 U.S. military bases, and the impacts at home are rarely talked about. I mean, here we've gone through these horrible hurricanes of late, and the lack of resources to help people prepare and then recover from is just very flagrant. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about not only what he called the madness of militarism, but another phrase he called this military spending demonic, destructive suction tube that is just taking money away from what we need here at home. And that's as true in 2024 as it was when he talked about it in 1967. I think the invisibility of war is so crucial in terms of not only far away, we don't really know what the U.S. is doing, bombing and helping other militaries to engage in their activities, but the invisibility of war at home. And in terms of recent events, when I was earlier this year working on this paperback edition of War Made Invisible, I thought about, well, how does invisibility apply to what has been happening in Gaza? And it's very much the conceit in U.S. media that somehow if you watch the news, if you read your newspaper, that somehow you know, you see what war is about. And that very conceit accentuates the falsity and the misunderstanding. You know, there's that saying, it's not what people don't know that bothers me, it's what they know that just ain't so. And if we think we know what war is about because this news coverage is telling us, then it's a double whammy because there are inherent limits to what journalism can convey about it's what it's really like to be in a war. War is about death. It's about terror. It's about maiming. And yet, in our news coverage, there's very little of that actually conveyed. And then another part of the invisibility in terms of the war on Gaza is that there's so much ethnic, religious, racial, and nationalistic bias that comes through. We've seen again and again how the Israelis who have suffered from Hamas attacks, they have been really treated with great empathy, as they should be. But it's relatively rare to have a personal kind of bit of coverage in terms of what Palestinian people are going through. And in terms of the title and subtitle of the book, I eventually got a handle on how War Made Invisible applies to what has been going on in Gaza. But then I thought about the subtitle, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. And it became clear to me that the Israeli military is part of the U.S. military machine. There is a separate command structure, but more than ever we've seen since October of 2023 that the so-called Defense Department of the United States and the so-called Israel Defense Force are really operating in an integrated way. And I think that's very important because, again, militarism is so ubiquitous and pervasive in U.S. society at so many levels, politically, economically, psychologically, in terms of media, in terms of adulation of the U.S. military. And that really has bled over and merged into the adulation given to the Israelis as supposedly fighting for a democracy in the Middle East. How can you have democracy when, as B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group, Amnesty International, and Human Rights Watch have been documenting for years that Israel is an apartheid state? So how can you have an apartheid state and still call it a democracy? One of the sort of gotcha questions that U.S. news media have been using very much during the war on Gaza is, do you think Israel has a right to exist? And we're all supposed to say yes. And my answer is, did apartheid South Africa have a right to exist? does apartheid Israel have a right to exist? Or if we're going to have a single standard of human rights, should we not be calling for a country that is truly respectful of all human beings rather than, in practice, as Israel is doing, proceed as though some human beings are expendable?
Hmm. Norman Solomon, you've written a very important book. People should get this book and read it, War Made Invisible. How can people get the book, and how can people follow your work?
A very easy way is just to go to the web, warmadeinvisible.org, and there'll be a lot of information there about the book. And also, my writing is on my website at normansolomon.com.
Well, Norman, once again, here on Law and Disorder, you've provided us with some information that certainly folks are not hearing on the mainstream media. And we thank you so much for bringing that untold story to all of our listeners.
Thanks a lot.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Hello, this is Ashley Ross, and welcome to the latest episode of Sound is Not a Language. For this recording, on January 31st, I'm coming to you from the opening of a solo exhibition, Chinua Achebe Behavior, by none other than our very own MFA cohort, Annie Chen. Before I get to the sounds of the opening reception, let's first talk about the charcuterie board. A lot of galleries and institutions don't understand that sometimes an opening reception is made by how good the food and drinks are. I'm being dead serious. And as a grad student, especially an art grad student, this is basically dinner. So I appreciated the attention to detail with the delicious selection of fruits, which included pineapples, melons, grapes, and strawberries. The meats and cheeses were of great quality as well. But let's talk about the most important part of the show, which is Annie's show. You can tell from how intricate some of the pieces are that there is an incredible amount of thought and research and investigation that goes into her practice and specifically the pieces. Also, experiencing her work outside of CMU has me appreciating her approach to her art practice even more. I love how, although her work considers colonization and migration through various methods of travel and experience, she's also considering and challenging the viewer to consider context and the environment. Her work never feels like she just slaps something together and calls it a day. She's constantly questioning, learning, and experimenting. And she takes the time to really understand what she's working with, and it shows. And so I'm super excited that we all got to go and experience Annie's show in person and have a good time and support, you know, building careers specifically within an MFA program. And it's exciting to see that somebody already has a solo show in the first year. So enjoy the sounds of an opening reception. I got to interview a few people. Enjoy. Congrats, Annie. How do you feel? It looks beautiful.
Thank you very much. This is the one you made. Yeah, I love that one. Yeah, I want to do that. Thank you.
competition?
Yeah, I'm in Annie's cohort. Okay. Yeah, we're both in the same MFA program.
Oh, great. Yeah. Are you also in the first year of your MFA? Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Do you have any kind of concentration on?
Yeah, I'm mostly photography. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you move to Pittsburgh for the program, or were you okay? Where from?
California.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. The Carnegie is a good program, right?
It's pretty good. It's enjoyable. It's been an interesting first year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great. And what's your name?
I'm Ashley.
Ashley?
Yeah.
I'm Josiah. I teach here at Seton Hill. I teach painting and drawing.
Oh, awesome. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you too. And thank you for coming and, supporting your friend. And that's great.
Yeah, she's awesome. And I'm excited to see. I haven't seen this work from her before. Like, I've seen mostly her sculptural things. So seeing these larger installations are really beautiful. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited. Support her.
Yeah, they look great in this space.
Yeah, this is like a good gallery space. It looks really nice. So.
Yes, we have two. This is the small one, and then the bigger one, the Harlan Gallery, just right there. And right now we have a student show.
Okay.
But it's a great gallery. We have these movable walls, like this wall here.
Mm-hmm.
You can move and readjust the gallery space. I love that we have that flexibility with the space. It's a great place to show.
Yeah, it looks great. Yeah.
Experience.
What are you experiencing right now?
I feel a little damp.
Oh, yeah.
I did look at myself in the mirror and I thought, wet rat. But I'm looking at a fabric piece that's approximately probably 15 feet long by 5, I would say. There's a ladder made out of soft sculpture fabric that protrudes down. There's a lot of objects remade as in soft sculpture and fabrics, different patterns. Some things are coming off the wall. There's a really beautiful spider web made out of chain. And there's some plasticky fabric that's making up a plant. It's nice.
I think I'm really enjoying seeing these very large installation pieces that I haven't seen yet from Annie's work.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like we're used to seeing some of like the sculptural pieces that she's been working on, but these are so like huge and like magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been appreciative of like her ability to like use different textures and patterns, and but yeah, it feels so very cohesive.
Yeah.
So I'm super happy for her and proud of her.
Yeah.
You know, and how it feels in this space too. Like, this is feels like a really great space to have her work live in as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
it has room to breathe.
Yeah, room to breathe. We also were gonna get you flowers, Annie.
Yes, we promise.
We promise we will get you flowers. What's your perspective on navigating an MFA program, but then also trying to build connections within the program? Like, Annie has a solo show. Do you think it's a good idea to, like, pursue building a career or, like, within the program, or just focus on making work?
I think you should only make work.
Okay.
But that's just me. I don't know, I just really valued all like the facilities and space and like the little built-in community of the program, and didn't do very much effort into leaving the building.
Mm-hmm.
But also like the second half of the program was all like during COVID when I was there. Was not a community. Which was great.
When did I graduate? Did you graduate?
2021.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't want to, like, prescribe what everybody should do, but for me, I was very happy to just show up and have it be a time to focus.
Just focus.
On
okay.
myself.
How do you think Annie's doing so far?
She's doing wonderful.
Yeah. Annie is amazing. We love you, Annie. Congrats.
Hi, my name is Penn Schenkweiler, and I'm 9 years old.
And I am Morgan Thomas Schenkweiler, and this is my interview of one of my twin daughters, Penn. Okay, Penn.
Where do you live?
I live in Pittsburgh.
How do you like Pittsburgh?
It's fine.
Our family moved to Pittsburgh in August so that I could go to grad school at CMU.
What do you like about it?
I like that it's big.
Okay. In what way?
In what way that there are things that I get to explore.
That there's always sort of new things that you haven't seen before? Mm-hmm. Nice.
I like the parks.
What do you like about the parks?
I like that they're big and have a lot of trees and nature.
I agree.
This radio program is called Is Sound a Language? And is part of the contextual practice component of the MFA program.
I want to ask you about sound. What is your relationship to sound?
Good.
You have a good relationship to sound? Yeah. Do you like sounds?
Sometimes, sometimes.
Okay. So what kind of sounds do you like?
I like nature sounds.
Like what?
Like the wind and the stream rushing and the leaves flapping against each other and the birds chirping.
Nice. What kind of sounds do you not like?
Car sounds, noisy yelling people sounds, people crunching sounds.
Like you don't like the sound of people eating?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a name for that.
What is it?
I don't remember what it is.
It's misophonia.
And I think I have that too, and I think your grandfather has that too. He hates the sound of people chewing. Especially with their mouth open. You don't like that sound either.
Yeah, I don't like that sound.
Do you like crunching food? Are you bothered by the sound of your own crunching noises in your own mouth?
No.
Me neither. I actually like, I prefer crunchy foods. What is your first memory of sound?
What do you mean?
I mean, if you can think back to when you were really little, do you remember any sounds specifically?
Yeah.
Like what?
Me and my sister fighting.
Really?
Yeah.
That's the sound you remember?
Yeah.
Huh. What did that sound like?
Yeah! But I also remember the wind.
The sound of the wind.
And the rain.
What other sounds do you remember from when you were little?
Dogs.
The sounds of dogs barking.
And lawnmowers.
And leaf blowers. Those are not my favorite sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember any music?
Our family is particularly musical. My father is a cellist and a violin maker, and my husband is a professional singer and conductor. One of my first memories of music is waking up in the morning and hearing my dad playing the cello. All children in our family have always been required to play some sort of musical instrument.
Do you remember any music, or do you not think of music as sound?
I do and I don't. I think it as sound because you can hear it, but I also don't because I enjoy nature more.
So you actually really like there to be a lot of quiet. Have you ever heard total silence?
Yes, kind of.
Where?
In my room.
At night?
Yeah, and also just if I'm sitting there in the morning and it's really quiet in the house.
Do you like that?
Yes, I really like it.
What is your relationship with music now?
I like it, and I also don't like it.
What do you like about it?
I like that it's calming if you're playing it beautifully.
Do you play an instrument?
Yes.
What instrument do you play?
Cello and piano.
Yeah. What don't you like about it?
That it doesn't always sound calm and beautiful.
You said that there are some sounds that you really don't like, and you said what? Chewing? Is one. What else?
Cars.
Oh, that's right, cars.
And just the sound of people screaming and making noises and stuff.
When you hear, like, lots of people in a room and they're loud, how does it make you feel?
Overwhelmed.
Yeah. Do you feel like that ever when you're out in nature?
No.
Have you ever been in nature, listening to nature sounds that got really loud?
Yes, but I actually don't mind those nature sounds. I don't mind loud sounds that come from nature.
You said that you don't really like loud noises, but are you a loud person or a quiet person, or both?
Both. I'm a loud person because that's how my dad is, and when I'm happy, I'm loud. Sometimes when I'm sad, I'm loud, but I'm quiet because, I don't know, I just enjoy quietness, and sometimes I just am a quiet person.
Does it help you to focus when you're quiet?
Yes.
Does it help you to calm down if you're in a quiet space?
Yes.
Have you ever listened to the radio?
Yes.
What do you listen to on the radio?
Music. Or if there are weird people talking, the weird people talking.
Weird people talking?
Here, I'm pretty sure she is talking about NPR.
Isn't it funny that now you're a weird person that's going to be talking on the radio?
Yes, but I'm already a weird person.
Speaking of this weird person, Penn had one desire and one desire only for what to talk about on her radio interview.
What do you want to teach me about today or tell me about in this interview?
I want to tell you about armadillos.
Okay, tell me about armadillos.
They're my favorite animal.
Why are they your favorite animal? What do you like about an armadillo?
I like that most people don't have them as their favorite animals. They're kind of another animal that, like, people kind of forget about, and I think they're really cute. I like that they have short, stubby legs, and they kind of are like knights in armor.
That's cool. It is cool that they have their own armor.
If I had an armadillo, I would name it Barney.
Barney?
Yeah.
Barney the armadillo. Okay, so what else do you know about armadillos?
There's only one kind lives in North America. It is the nine-banded armadillo.
Nine-banded? Does that mean it has stripes?
Like the nine bands on the back. Yeah. That's what it means.
Got it.
There are 21 kinds of armadillos in all. They live in burrows. They eat insects. Spiders and scorpions, they can smell termites inside a mound. And they use their sticky tongues to grab the food.
That's really cool. I didn't realize they have sticky tongues.
But they use their claws to dig for food.
So they dig, and then they stick their sticky tongues down and grab the bugs?
Mm-hmm. They cannot see well, but their sense of smell is strong.
They don't have good sight, but they have really good smelling and hearing.
They can see things, but it's not.
It's not their best sense. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, they're different than us.
Yes.
In that way. Do you think it's quiet underground?
I think it might be quiet because it's, like, underground and, like, there's nothing there. But I think it might be loud because all the bugs are in there.
it's really cool for me to think about what an area that we aren't in might sound like.
Yeah, well, some armadillos make loud squealing sounds.
Loud squealing sounds? When do they make that sound? Do they? Can armadillos talk to each other? Do armadillos have radio stations?
No!
Do they make radio programs for other armadillos?
No.
If you had an armadillo right now, right here, named Barney, what do you think that armadillo would want to say on the radio?
I'm hungry. Or I'm tired.
Why do you think that?
It's the daytime right now and they're nocturnal, so...
Oh, yeah. They'd probably want to be sleeping, huh?
And also, armadillos are shy animals. People try to study them in the wild. In Texas, you can see many places.
Did you know that the word armadillo is Spanish for little armored one? Armadillo.
An armadillo has a carapace for protection. There are about 2,000 scales covering this bone. Bands made of skin connect the parts of the carapace.
Cool. So it actually is kind of like chainmail on a knight. Okay, I think we're almost done. Is there anything else you want to tell us about?
There is an armadillo tail.
Ooh, excellent.
People in South America have a story about an armadillo who was musical. Armadillo loved music. He wished he could sing like the frogs and crickets. A musician told armadillo that his wish would come true, but armadillo would have to wait a long time. After armadillo lived a long and happy life, he died. The musician made his shell into a beautiful instrument. Armadillo sang at last.
Ooh, is there really an instrument made out of armadillo shell?
Probably, but I don't know what.
At this point, a little Google search comes in handy.
Yeah, there is one. It is called the charango. Do you think there's music of the charango somewhere? Let's see. Yeah, you ready? The charango. Which one would you rather listen to? The screaming of an armadillo or the charango?
Actually,
you are listening
like
to Is Sound a Language?
Annie Chen.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
My name is Logan Larson. Over winter break, I saw the revival of the musical Sunset Boulevard on Broadway. The movie turned musical, and subsequent revivals have a long history, both in their presentations and in the stars that took on the role of Norma Desmond. In case you aren't familiar, the 1950 film Sunset Boulevard centers around a down-and-out writer who stumbles upon the mansion of former silent film star Nora Desmond, who is plotting her revival on screen. She employs the writer to edit a screenplay she hopes will facilitate her big comeback, a depiction of the story of Salome, in which she will play the 16-year-old character. Desmond, a film star of the silent film era, couldn't break into the new medium at the advent of talking pictures. Jaded and haunted by her lost fame, the reality of her situation becomes too real as her obsession over the writer she employs turns deadly after her confession of love for him. ending with one of the most iconic lines in film history, where Desmond slowly descends the stairs of her mansion and utters the line, "Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up." My interest in Sunset Boulevard emerged after an encounter in the archives at the Harry A. Ransom Center in Austin, Texas. The Ransom Center holds the archival collection of Gloria Swanson, the actress who originated the role of Desmond in the original Billy Wilder film from 1950. The collection includes 620 boxes of archival materials, almost 292 linear feet of material, which include personal photographs, fan mail, scripts, and related materials from her health foods activism, among a litany of other items. The collection is whispered about by archivists and interns at the Ransom Center because of a notorious object included in the archive, a small, handmade coffin painted green that arrived at the archive filled with sugar. The coffin has the pan-painted text, "Hic jacet Gloria Swanson," or when translated, "Here lies Gloria Swanson," painted on its top. The coffin is rough, obviously quickly made, but is undeniably the thing it aims to represent. The coffin is part of a series of anonymous hate mail sent from the filmmaker Kenneth Anger to Swanson in the late 1970s. Alongside the coffin, other items include a series of annotated postcards which depict cartoon cats engaging in surreal scenarios. These scenes include a wedding, a family photograph, a hair salon, and a moving scene, among a few others. Anger has sequenced them and typed references to moments in Swanson's life directly on the illustrations and added the statement, "This is your life," to the back of each. Then there is also the photograph of her and the actor Rudolph Valentino,